You're listening to the Denver Real Estate Investing Podcast, where it's all about helping you grow your Denver real estate portfolio. Here's your host, Chris Lopez.
All right, Charles, why don't you take it away?
Hi, everybody. This is Charles Roberts. I'm the president of Your Castle Real Estate, and I have in the studio a guest that I asked to come in because we were having breakfast a couple of weeks ago, and we were sitting next to each other at this group that we meet with every couple of weeks, and he was telling me a little bit about an adventure he's been having in St. Louis. He picked up some properties there, and we hear five times a day, folks ask us, should I buy in Denver? Should I buy out of town? And it's a great question. And there's no absolute black and whites. So much of it depends on you, your strengths, your weaknesses, where you'd want to buy, what your expectations are. But when Vern told me and started to begin to give me the story on what he's been up to, I said, Vern, I'd love to have you in and just let you talk and tell people what you did, why you did it, what the results have been, what the future is looking like. So I'm pretty much just going to hand it over to you. And first off, say thanks very much for taking the time. People really, really appreciate this incredibly timely information because you're in the middle of it right now. So take it away. Tell us what's happened.
Thanks, Charles. Actually, this is one of my first deals that I ever did as an investor. I went to Denver was way too high for me. So I started looking out of state and found St. Louis to be somewhat attractive. So I went out there and did a little legwork and met some people out there. And that was pretty important to get a lay of the land because St. Louis is pretty dicey. And if you go from one block to another, you'll find completely different neighborhoods from a burned out house to a brand new build. So you really have to have somebody out there to know what's going on. My first deal out there was actually a bank REO type of a deal that somebody had turned me on to, and I ended up wholesaling that. It was started off at 13 properties and ended up at 9 properties. And we got rid of that one. And then because I had done that deal, I had a property manager tell me about another deal that came up, and it had 13 properties on it. So my original intent with that was to wholesale it. And we started off with some numbers. It was probably in the 500 range. And we just couldn't get the deal done. It was too high. And so we kept trying and trying and trying. And at one point, we ended up getting close to 300 on it. And I think I decided at that point I would try to take it down myself. So we offered, I think it was 250 on the 13 houses. And they said yes, which really surprised me.
Okay. So 250,000 for 13 houses. Tell us about them. Neighborhoods, conditions, size. Give us everything.
They are all in the same town, pretty much. Belleville is where we ended up. And it's actually in Illinois, across the river. And I chose that area because it's stable. As far as block to block, it's pretty much a C-plus town. I'd call the whole town C-plus, or maybe a couple areas that are B.
So a lot of people will be listening to us from Denver. Can you give us an idea, like what would be a local neighborhood that might compare to it?
Oh, I would probably say Mid-Aurora is probably a good comparison, mid to North Aurora.
Okay, that's great. Perfect.
That's a good comparison. And I met a property manager out there. She's the one that turned me onto this deal. And it was one of her clients that was looking to get out of it. So what I did was when they decided that they would take that money, I went out and found a partner locally and offered it up to him, and we put a deal together. And so it was my local money partner, myself, and we put the property manager into the deal as well. And we took down the 13 houses. And then over the last couple of years, we bought 6 houses, sold one of them. We have another one for sale right now. And so I think we're going to end up, we've got one house that we changed to a duplex. It was a single family, had originally been a duplex, converted to single family. It's going through a process right now where we're going to make a duplex again. And that is vacant today. It's almost ready. And we have one other vacancy out of 17, I think, is where we're sitting today, with one house sold on a lease option.
Now, what's your typical like vacancy out there? I mean, Denver, there's practically zero vacancy. What's it like out there?
It's about 13% on average.
Okay.
So it's a little higher than Denver.
Yeah, that is. I mean, that's actually, we hit 13.4% in 2003, and I was a young investor with a lot of property. So I definitely know what that was like. And it was, that was the highest in recorded history here in Denver. So, okay. So, you know, relatively high, but you go in knowing that. That's part of your spreadsheet.
Is that kind of the historical norm out there, right around 13%?
It's where it's been for the last few years, yes.
And then what are the numbers like on these properties? I mean, like, you can't buy a house for $250 in Denver, yet you bought 13 houses. Like, what do they rent for? I mean,
God, yeah. I'm doing the math in my head. That's incredible.
Our model is to buy them for $20,000 and rehab for less than $10,000, so we'd be $30,000 all in. That's what we're shooting for. And the average rents that we're getting out there, $600, $700, $800. We've got one that's a little bit more than $900 right now.
That's great. Okay, so the adventure starts, you buy it, then what happens, good and bad?
Well, the bad. Let's start with the bad. We inherited a lot of bad tenants. And that could be why the previous people wanted out. So it took a while to get through those bad tenants and cycle them out and get some good tenants.
Is that because of the laws in Illinois, was it? How much of it is a state law situation?
Illinois is pretty landlord or tenant friendly. So that's a little difficult, but it wasn't that much of an issue. It was just letting time go by to get through the leases that were in place.
Oh, I see. That you had active leases.
Right. So getting through those, and then the houses are kind of beat up. And we had one tenant who decided to take a vacation in late November and turned off the heat. And come December, it was broken pipes and cost us probably $7,000. So those kind of things are kind of tough.
Okay. So kind of fast forward, that was the tough part. And that was, you weren't expecting them to be that bad, that would didn't meet your expectations?
It was a little bit of a surprise. You know, you go in thinking everything's going to be rosy, and it's not always. And that was probably the biggest issue that we've had.
So let's think about lessons learned. So people riding their bike right now or listening to this on a walk with the dogs, what are the lessons that you would wish you had been told on a podcast 2 years ago?
Well, that's a good question. Some of the surprises that I wasn't anticipating when I spreadsheeted is common out there for the utilities to be paid by the landlord.
What does the lease say?
I don't recall offhand, but I'm seeing that on the P&Ls. And when I questioned the manager, that's pretty typical out there.
Ugh. Oh, so that's $700 or $800 is with you paying utilities.
Right.
Okay. That's a really, really good point, because then you have tenants who have zero incentive to, you know, not water and heat things. So would $700 equate to what here? If it's a home where the tenant's paying utilities, is it like $100 a month, $150, something like that?
Oh, we're paying probably $1,000 a month in all the utilities.
Okay. So $80 a month per unit. Okay. So $700 might equate to $620 in kind of Denver sort of dollars. Okay. That's really helpful. Any early lessons learned from all of the due diligence that you did or wish you had done?
I think it was pretty thorough. There were no real big surprises that we ran into. Having the manager in place, she was familiar with the town, had grown up in it, had done several flips out there. That was probably the biggest plus. And I don't think I'd want to do something like that without having somebody like that in place.
And she's still your manager?
She's still our
manager. So the good news is you have somebody on the ground, what, a year and a half later?
We're into about 2.5 years.
Two and a half years later, and she's still working for you. That is a huge, huge bonus that she's done a good job.
She's done a good job.
So how did you find her? Because everyone always wants, you know they need good people on the ground over there. How'd you get in touch with her?
When I did my first deal out there as a wholesale, I called around and started talking to some people to see what it would take to manage these, just for education purposes. And that was in an area where nobody wanted to touch.
Really? Because they just don't make any money at $700 a month?
No, this is a rough area where these others were. It's just a rough area. It's kind of like south of East St. Louis. And you know, when I first did the analysis on it, there was hardly any crime reported at all. So this is an aha thing that I learned. And I looked at this town and thought, cool, no crime. It looks nice. You know, street views are nice. And everything on the surface looked really good. And the other town that we're actually in now, it had a lot of crime report. You know, there's assaults and thefts and just your typical type of crime that you'd find in a seedy neighborhood. So I just kind of stayed away from that. I don't think I even toured it the first time I went out there. I remember I talked to an attorney and told him what I was doing, and he kind of looked at me and tilted his head and said, why would you want to be there? Why aren't you over in Belleville? And I said, well, the crime's pretty high over there. Then what I discovered after being out there a couple of times was the reason the crime was low is because they're so used to it, they don't report it.
Who doesn't report it?
The neighbors.
The victims, right?
Yeah. It's so commonplace that they just don't even bother calling the cops. They live that way.
Now, is it gang-related? Is it more like, hey...
No, it's just, it's a D neighborhood is what I would call it. It's a D neighborhood. It's low income, and they're used to it. I went to get gas one morning, and there's a couple of guys at the gas station picking up their malt 45s, and there's the gas attendant behind bulletproof glass serving them. And that's when I realized, there's something fishy about this
I
place.
I better be getting a 16 cap. Yeah.
So Google Street View didn't show you that perspective of things.
No, it didn't.
So.
Yeah, but on the plus side, you know where to buy your drugs now. So it's just balance, right?
On my malt 45.
Or your malt 45, whatever it takes. All right, so let's see. So how did it go with having the leases dry up and people leaving? Did anybody not want to leave?
Yeah, we had some people that had been there for a while. We've got a few Section 8. And then we had some, you know, the typical turnover and a few bad tenants we had to get rid of. But it took a little while. With 13% vacancy, it probably takes a month and a half to 2 months or 3 months, depending on the property, to get them filled up again.
So you're saying if you have it ready to be leased on January 1st, you might be into March?
We might.
That's very interesting. So that's certainly different from our market, but something that I recall because I had 29 units at 13% vacancy. Okay, so that's certainly a difference in here.
Yeah.
Okay, that sounds good. So where are you now, 2.5 years later? Well, how long did it take for you to feel like you had 13 properties with the right mix of tenants, more or less?
It probably took a year and a half at least.
How much time did you put in? You had a great property manager, which changes everything. You actually had a professional on the ground, and that's phenomenal. And that's what we've seen people fall apart on and not have it. But you had that. Were you putting in an hour a week, 10 hours a day? How many times did you fly out there? What was your life like managing the situation?
Not bad, actually. I probably went out there 4 or 5 times. And I've been out there since I got the deal done. I've been out there twice. And I haven't been out for maybe a year.
Okay.
Now, you said that you actually brought the property manager in on the deal, right? So she's a part owner. Correct. Did you do that so she would have skin in the game, be more proactive? Because I feel like that makes a big difference between paying you 10% versus, hey, you're a X percentage owner in the property. Is that like a strategic play on your part or...
Yes, it was.
Okay, so what a great idea to add. So this partner, so is this your only partner or do you have multiple partners?
We have two partners. I've got a money partner here and her out there. Okay. So there's three of us.
But
in
she owns a portion of these, therefore she has a built-in incentive.
And did she ask you for that or did you kind of float it by? Or I'm curious, you don't have to go into details, but like, did you say, hey, I want this and hey, I want you to have a piece of the action?
I wanted her in on the deal.
For exactly that reason. Yeah, now I understand why that went so well, because I don't hear that very often. I honestly don't. But it's because you cut her into the deal, so she has a great incentive to do this.
She manages 100-plus doors, and these 18 are very important to her because it's her retirement, too.
Phenomenal. That's really cool. That's a big lesson learned right there. At this point, 2.5 years later, do you feel that they're essentially where they need to be?
Well, we've got the one duplex that we need to get finished up. And once we have that one done, I can accept an empty here and there.
Mm-hmm. 13%, you know, a 1 out of 7 empty, right? Like it's going to be something like 13%.
1 out of 17 at that point. So it would be less than the 13%. Right now we've got 3 units that are empty because of the duplex, but we get that thing full and it's almost ready. It's probably a month or two away from being passing the city code. And that's another probably $1,200 a month to the bottom line. And then we're pretty close to projections minus the rubs that we weren't anticipating.
But you're going to be having a 13% vacancy because that's normal for that market. You expect it to be maybe a little better because she has a little more incentive to put it in her own places, but something like that.
Yeah.
So if I was to ask you for a pro forma, a cap rate right now, that would include, you know, all the expenses, you know, what you're into it, what your net operating income is divided by the purchase price, also putting in, you know, maybe some travel, like what it's going to take for you if you do need to go out there once a year or something. Like, to me, that's where the rubber meets the road, is what kind of cap rate are you getting on this portfolio of properties?
Today with the vacancies, I think we're around 17.
That's unbelievable. That makes it all worthwhile, right? This is part of your retirement here, and that is just incredible.
Yeah, we're hoping to get some appreciation when we bought them. back then, I think Zillow or Realtor.com, one of them had a graph, and you could kind of see where the home prices were, and we were at the bottom. I don't think we could go any lower. So, you know, we were just hoping that, hey, a little icing on the cake would be to see that increase a little bit. And it might, you know, from $20,000 houses to 5 years, maybe there'll be $30,000 houses.
I mean, that's an absolutely incredible cap rate. And from your perspective, 2.5 years into this, would you do it again with what you know now? Is that a big enough cap rate to go through what you went through?
Well, that's a good question. It has its challenges, and there's always concerns because of where it's at. It's a long ways away. It's in an unfriendly state, you know, and Illinois is threatening to go bankrupt, and that is concerning.
Why?
Just taxes.
Oh, they've had huge fiscal issues. Yeah. Yeah. What are property taxes like out there?
They're pretty high. Our $30,000 houses, we're paying probably $1,200 a year in taxes.
That's so interesting.
And are they talking about possibly raise them to help, you know,
well,
make the budget
we haven't
gap?
Heard that discussion yet, but it's always a concern. It's Illinois.
But are the property taxes not local?
Yeah, they're local tax.
So is the local towns having problems too? Like, is that what would affect your property taxes?
I don't think Belleville is going to have as much trouble as the whole state would have because it does siphon off of St. Louis. We're literally not even 10 minutes from downtown Denver or downtown St. Louis. So it's a good area for the blue-collar workers that live down or work downtown.
So back to the question, you're getting a 17 cap, which is just unheard of, but you're not overly convinced you'd do it again.
Well, I see similar things going on right now down in Pueblo. I think that we could get the same thing in Colorado without the plane ticket.
And that kind of cap rate? That kind of return?
I've seen houses down there for $30,000, $40,000. You know, they rent for $600.
Yeah, I've been getting those wholesale emails. Yeah.
Uh-huh. and it's been that way for a while, too. And granted, they're only getting $600. Maybe they could get $700 if they're fixed up a little bit. And it's a little depressed down there, but it's a little depressed out east, too. So I just think that if I do it again, I'd probably look a little closer just to not have the long distance. And I think those opportunities are down there. And you could go out east and probably find something in the eastern plains at Lyman, Sterling, that type of thing. Okay. So I think there's opportunities local in our state that I would be looking at as well.
So what made you focus on St. Louis in the first place, just from like the big picture point of view while you're at Google saying, oh, where do I want to invest? What made you pick St. Louis?
Oh, I had gone through a Larry Goins class of cheap houses, basically. And I had enough money to do a few cheap houses. So I thought, well, I can't afford anything in Denver. I was very green because this was like my first or second deal. And I thought, well, if I can't afford Denver, then what can I afford? So I started looking for that model, you know, the $15,000 house that you could do something with.
Yep.
So I started going across the country. Jacksonville looked pretty good back then, but there was a lot of crime going on there. And I ended up in St. Louis, and I thought, well, that's close enough that, you know, it's a quick flight.
How long is a flight out there?
2 hours.
Okay. And then going back, I wanted to ask you towards the beginning. So you bought the houses for about $20,000 a piece, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if there was just an individual house like that for sale at the time on the MLS, whatever way, like what would the, how much of a discount did you get just to give us some context here?
By buying the package?
Yeah, by buying the package. Like you bought the whole package for about $20,000 a piece. If it was just one house that a realtor was listing out there, would it sell for what?
We've picked them up, I think the last one we bought for $25,000. And it didn't need much to get it going.
So you got a little discount with the whole package. I mean, that might be 20%, come to think of it, and yet it's only $5,000, but something like a few thousand discount.
Right. But on the flip side of that, I also picked up one for $15,000. And it had been, I think, a VA foreclosure or something like that. We put $7,000 in it. We're getting $775 out of that.
What does the realtor make on that? What does the buyer's agent make? Tell me it's not 2.8.
No, it's not. They make at least $1,500 is. So they, you know, it's not much. But yeah, 2.8 wouldn't do much for anybody.
You get a free lunch and a cup of coffee, huh? So generally speaking, I know you have a money partner, but are properties that low, is that even financeable for like through a lender, do you know? Or is that, those are going to be all cash deals, right?
For the most part, we did a portfolio loan For the big package.
With the local bank?
With the local bank.
Okay, and how was that? How were they to work with?
It wasn't too bad. I had to do a lot of phone calls to find one that would do it. But after, it probably took 8 or 10 before I found a banker that would do it. And
5-1 arm?
No, I think we, let's see, what did we get? It's been a while. I think we're paying 7% for 20 years is what we had.
It's 20, so there's no balloon?
No, I think we got it for 20. Yeah.
Fully am with no balloon? Because that makes a big difference, because God forbid if the market goes down, you don't have a balloon in 5 or 7 years staring in the face. Right. Fantastic.
We've been taking all the funds and first paying back the investor for the rehabs and what he's put in. And then the rest of the funds are going to pay down the note quicker. So we're not taking any cash out of the deal yet. And we don't expect to for a number of years. But, you know, once we have it paid off, then it'll cash flow pretty well.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Any sleepless nights?
Oh, initially, during the deal, I had a lot of sleepless nights.
Good, yeah, during the club.
Yeah, and it was, it was so fresh. I just didn't know what I was doing, so I had to turn to some mentors and get some help through it. But aside from that, once we got it done and got things going, again, I think the biggest key is having somebody out there who understands the business and is our person.
Yeah, is an owner. I mean, I'm going so far as to say that sounds like a brilliant strategy to cut somebody in.
I think for long distance investing, I never thought of it before, but now it's just like so obvious because you got skin in the game and you're going to be better off and less trips out there. Like it just, now it's like, wow, that is a huge takeaway.
That helped me with the financing too, because when I went to the money guy and I told him what we were doing and that we were putting her in the deal, that was the key.
So the money guy, don't tell me names, but what does this mean? Who, what kind of person is this money guy?
He's a local investor and I met him at a club and he had some money to spend and had, was looking for opportunities.
He's a guy. He's just a guy that you met and you guys talked and he said, I'd like to be a silent partner and I'll pony up the 250 or something like that.
Something like that. Yeah. I mean, he's involved in it, but it was a good opportunity for him and for myself as well.
So people ask all the time, they'll come and they'll say, look, I don't have any money. How can I get into investing? And this is exactly what I say is if you don't have money and have no chance of getting any for a while, then you need to provide some value. So what you did is you provided the value and there was money that would associate with you. That's the perfect answer. If you don't have the money, the luxury of actually being able to use your money. And that's exactly what I did 17, 18 years ago, is I partnered up with someone who had gobs of money because I was providing the value he didn't have at that time. He, by the way, is now over 600 units in his portfolio. So a very, very wealthy individual. But that was exactly what it worked. We complemented each other. You provided the value. You might have brought the deal and might have said to him, look, here's a great use for your money. So if you're listening to this podcast, learn from exactly what Vern did here.
What would you recommend for people to go out there and build that relationship? You just don't go out to the weekly investor club meeting and say, hi, I'm Chris. Can you lend me money? It's not quite that simple, or I don't think it is.
No, it's not that simple. Keep your ears open. That's important. Because if people are looking for deals and they have money to spend, they will say something. It's a matter of recognizing opportunity.
And you haven't been in this business that long, is that correct?
No, I started investing in 14.
Yeah. I mean, not that long. I remember when you started. And are you still wholesaling?
Yes.
Is that anything you want to talk about? Like
most of what we're doing is co-wholesaling at this point because I've got such a good network and I've got a lot of people that come to me and ask me to send their deals out.
Yeah. Did you do one with Barry recently?
Yes.
Yeah, so did I. So we were both in on that. Thank you very much, Barry. We had breakfast with him and he told me that you had brought the deal to him. So you co-wholesaled and I assisted him with things and I got my little check. You got your little check and everybody's happy.
So what is co-wholesaling? I've not heard that before.
Co-wholesaling is working with other wholesalers. And actually, that was the impetus for me getting my license, my real estate license, because the real estate commission basically says if you're co-wholesaling, you need to be licensed unless you have the equity in the property. So if somebody is as a wholesaler, really? Goes out there and has the equity in the property, and they send it off and somebody else blasts it out for them, according to the real estate commission, what my attorney told me was that wasn't allowed.
No kidding. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it raised some flags when I sat down with Greg Parham and talked about it.
If Greg says it, it's right.
He pulled out the book and showed me that. And it's like, that was the impetus for me getting my license, because I wanted to do that. I have a good network. And I figured, hey, let's get rid of the gray areas and have it black and white. So I did.
Can people reach out to you? I, you know, definitely don't want you to get flooded with stuff, but to what extent or in what way would it be okay if people had questions on wholesaling or what you're doing out of state or anything that they get in touch with you?
Absolutely. Yeah. I try to be an open book, because everybody that I asked questions of when I got started was an open book to me. So, you know, you want to pass that along. My number's 303-888-0078. And I also want to mention that I'm involved in the assisted living space. So if anybody's interested in that space, I run that group, Denver ALR, and we meet the last Wednesday of every month. And that's an interesting space. It's probably a whole nother podcast for that one.
Well, give me like the 2-minute rundown on that. So are you putting together investors to buy buildings or complexes? Like, just, I know what assisted living is, but what's the investing angle on there?
So there's a number of investing angles on that. I'm working at A Better Way Realty right now, and we actually have 7 assisted livings that we do triple net leases to the operators. So we will actually go out there and buy that property for an operator that's wanting to expand, and then lease it back to them and give them an option to buy it. And it's a triple net lease. We just did a deal a couple months ago for 4 of these. It was like 52 beds and about a $5 million deal. They're going to lease it for 2 to 3 years and then come in and get some financing and buy the 4 properties.
Without going down on giant rabbit hole here, because you got my attention peak. I'm just curious, like, what do you know off the top of your head? Like, what is a cap rate on a triple net assisted living facility? Like, I just have no idea the numbers behind it.
We're getting 9% on those deals.
Wow.
Wow. Okay. That is really impressive. Okay. We may have to bring you back on here and talk more about that in detail, because that is, I don't know anything about the world, and it's just so interesting now.
Yeah. And they're hard to finance. So we're a good answer for those that are having some issues trying to get through that financing. Plus it helps them get started, because they can reserve their cash for operating.
And you left your phone number. Is there an email or website you want to drop out there too?
Email is vern@grandavenueventures.com. And we have a website for the group. It's called denveralr.org.
Denveralr.org?
Yes.
Great. And so for you guys out there listening, I'll put those in the show notes as well, so you can click on them or come back and reference them later. So, Vern, hey, thanks for coming out and spending some time with us.
Thanks.